Well, we're entering to the part where we want to describe what it was like when we first came and did this. I remember personally, I was 29 years old. I had just joined the staff here at Metro Christian Fellowship. And suddenly, the word, it's time to build the house of the Lord.
I mean, you'd been on staff 3 months and we announce it.
Yes.
Ish. 3 months-ish?
Well, I'd come on right at the beginning of January. I'd gotten the word that I was going to be joining staff. That's right. I turned 30 in March, so I was 29 when I first heard of this. And as bizarre as it was for you to see that man in that coat in the back of the room that day when he told you of it, for us who were in our 20s, I remember it was the strangest thing I'd heard. I remember going, we are going to do unceasing worship and prayer until Jesus returns. I mean, you said things like, we're going to open the door and throw away the key, and the doors will never be locked till Jesus comes. I thought, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I think I want to do this. This is like impossible, I think. I mean, the Moravians did it, but I mean, I've never heard of this. And I remember at 29 years of age being struck to the heart. And I don't even know if I understood it. I don't even know if I understood half or a quarter of what you said. But I know this, at 29 years of age, it pierced my heart that this was such a noble venture that I would set my heart before the audience of one, before that one man that's sitting at the right hand of God who longs to come back. And that I would be that person who touches him in that way with unceasing adoration and prayer. In fact, it was so grand at the time. I remember there were people who had left everything to do it. I remember at the age of 29, it was one thing for me to leave. I mean, I was a pastor, and to go from pastoring, where you get a salary and it has a certain prestige, to joining a group in a welded together trailer, raising support. It was unproven. It was untested. It was unheard of. And to do that was risky. But there's something in the riskiness that makes you want to do it, right? There's something in the impossible. I remember Ann House left her career. I remember there was a NASA scientist who left his career just to come to this trailer. But I want to tell you, even as we came to that trailer, something took hold of our hearts, and it was so lofty, so grand. It was like this to me. You remember when Mary of Bethany, you talked about Mary of Bethany a lot. You remember you said you're going to waste your life on something, and Mary wasted it on him. And you would use those phrases like, waste your life. You know, give the extravagant devotion, wholehearted response to God. And I remember thinking it being so noble that those who did it before it was popular, that it would be a memorial to God. I remember saying, you know what? If I get a chance to do it, I've heard, because I heard all the prophetic history. I heard it. But suddenly we had an invitation to be part of it. We were able to be the group that actually started it. That had a nobility. I remember, how old were you, Misty, when you received that invitation when he spoke? And what was it like for you to say yes?
I was 19 years old. I remember being in this building on May 7th and walking into that prayer. And we started here, and then we went down to the trailers. And I remember walking in after hearing the grand vision and everything. And thinking,
wait, I'm going to say this. We had a conference here, and so I told the vision for an hour here, and we dedicated it here. Then we got in the car and went down, and 200 of us jammed in the trailer and dedicated it a second time.
Yeah, and I remember walking into that building and feeling like I was home. I mean, I heard the Holy Spirit say, you know, welcome home. And then the rubber hit the road after that. Because there's something, you have to work that muscle. When there's nobody in the room, there was no future for IHOP. I mean, it was like, this does not make sense. It made sense the night he gave the vision, you know what I mean? It sounded really accurate, and you knew there was something to it. So you signed up.
But the morning after.
It didn't make sense.
The morning
no
after, the next day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
But we were in it, and so there we go. You know, we were doing it, and you had to work that muscle over and over. Why am I not making money? Why am I not pursuing a career? I'm wasting my life. Like time, I have that feeling that time was escaping me, and I was, is this really going to be a smart choice? And I just told the Lord, I'm going to give you 10 years. I said, I'll do this without looking back. This meaning the prayer room. I'll fast. I'll pray. I'll get in the word. I'm not going to complain for 10 years. I'm going to do this thing. And if it doesn't work, I'll still be pretty young. I'll go get a job. That's what I said. It worked. It worked, though.
I do remember hearing the call to be Mary of Bethany. So you get into the house of prayer and you go stand there before the Lord and go, here I am. I'm Mary. I'm wasting my life. This feels not as glorious as when Mike invited us to waste our life.
I just remember as Mike was sharing the vision for the house of prayer, I was 19 at the time, and I was thinking of Julie Meyer and Joanne McFadder and different ones who had been here since 1983, and that they had been waiting for 16 years for the house of prayer. And I show up in Kansas City, and 6 months later, the Lord says, now's the time, and I got to enter into it. I just remember feeling such a sobriety and such a fear of the Lord over that reality, and even just going to the prayer room that first night on May 7th, I was with someone else in a car, and we were just talking about the fear we had of the Lord in that place, that we wanted to sing songs of holiness. And we were actually talking about, we were afraid if we sang something wrong, you know, he might strike us dead. We didn't know. We just had such a sobriety about the beginning of the house of prayer.
Yeah, there really was such a sense of the fear of the Lord, that it was holy. This was a holy occupation. And in fact, one of the subject matters of it being holy unto the Lord was the Leviticus 6:13. How many of you remember that? The fire on the altar shall never go out. And so once we started 24/7, that began to grip us. There was that sense of dread. You better not be the one. As a matter of fact,
that was a sense of dread, all right. That was like an echo in your brain. The fire's going to go out. The fire's going to go out.
It's still in my brain.
There weren't many singers and
no,
musicians.
No, wait. I like that.
You did
it
not want to be
preaching,
the one.
You're preaching, I'm like, somebody better be on the fire. Still to this day.
Someone's keeping it on right now, but go ahead, Misty.
It was incredibly haunting.
I remember, I don't think anybody slept very well during that initial time, because you just had that dread that you were going to oversleep and miss your shift somehow. And there wasn't just all these replacements. There was no replacement.
There were no replacements.
No, if you didn't wake up, we had to keep going.
That's right.
We wanted you to wake up.
Yeah, if the 6 a.m. crew did not come in, the night watch, nobody could stop. Who wants the fire to go out on their watch?
We weren't going to stop if you didn't show up, so I'm glad you woke up.
And we had some pretty intense close calls, or at least terrifying moments in terms of keeping the fire on the altar. I mean, I remember one of them being the ice storm that hit, where we lost power. It was 2002. We lost power for 3 days, and we are in there with coats on. We are in there with hats on. We have these little, like, kerosene heaters, and we're just crowding around there. We had to find acoustic guitars to play all the sets on, and it was freezing in there as we're going through that.
Yeah, a cappella, the way David really did it. And I remember one time in the middle of the night, we had just gone back and forth. Like, I did a Devo, and there was only like 2 or 3 of us there. I don't know why there was no one there this night. We were so tired.
You talking about the ice storm?
No, this was a different night. We were so tired. We were just like done. Our voices were hurting. And we look around, and we're like, who can do the next hour? We just need someone to do the next hour. And Rick Banning, you guys remember Rick Banning? He says,
we
well, I'll do
Rick
it.
Southern Baptist preacher.
Yeah.
From Kansas.
Like, yeah, an older guy. And he says, well, I'll do it. And we're like, but you don't play an instrument. And he's like, I'll do it anyway. We're like, you know what? Just don't let the fire go out. And he sat there for an hour and sang a cappella, song after song for an hour. But the fire did not go out.
That's right.
I think he sung all the hymns he knew.
I think he played the djembe.
Yeah, he was playing the djembe. He was
there was a little something going on.
He played the djembe.
Misty, tell us about the Chris DiCanio one.
Well, the Chris DiCanio one, Chris DiCanio would threaten. She wasn't really a section leader at that time, but she was kind of the leader. Chris DiCanio was always the leader.
She was just in charge.
She was in charge. And she would threaten, if you don't show up or if you're late, I will get up and play chopsticks. She said it so much that I actually thought it happened. And I was just asking her, hey, when did that happen? She goes, no, it never happened. She said, I just said it so much. So that was always looming over our heads.
I love you, Krista Canio.
Krista Canio was going to play Chopsticks, or Mike was going to sing. Both bad options.
We had so many.
That's about the which is worse.
Yeah. I remember Chris saying that over and over again. And I remember sometimes also things that are not actually instruments being incorporated into keeping the fire on the altar. I remember a specific worship leader in the night shift who was leading worship, and there was nobody in the room, and he just needed a moment for a Selah. And so he literally, somebody was, the only person in there was somebody vacuuming in the room. And so he sings a song and then just pauses and goes, just the vacuum, worship the Lord.
Also having the problem of doing a devotional, we had a worship leader who was doing a devotional on the keys with no sound person, needed a sound adjustment, so he jimmied the pedal so that it would hold on a pad so he could go back and fix his sound and came back. And
Marcus Meyer.
But it kept playing. So
the fire
it kept
was
going.
Not left alone.
We also had a worship leader who just was falling asleep. I mean, there was a time there where we did 3 hours straight of worship. And so he just did the same thing, put something on a loop and ran down the hallway to the little break room, chugged some coffee and ran right back into his set.
As a matter of fact, three of you were part of the first internship, Misty and Shelley and Alicia, and I think it was Luke Sullivan and Aaron Walsh.
Yeah, there's five total, the first internship.
And I think you divided them up all across the schedule.
Right, like I told Nick, I said, Nick, we got it covered. I got five workers, and even if they all can sing, every one of them. I mean, Aaron, you know, me and Aaron were in the same category, but we could sing. We could keep the fire in the altar, but we spread them across the 24 hours, and they all carried like 6 or 8 hours. I mean, it was intense what you guys did.
And the amazing thing was, is like I felt like I was getting the deal of a lifetime. I mean, because mm-hmm. all of us, the Lord had really impacted our hearts. It was the three of us, and then Aaron Walsh and Luke Sullivan. It was Alicia, Misty, and myself, and those two guys. And I just felt like I won the greatest lottery ever, that I got to pitch in and do whatever it was, whether it was rebuking people twice my age, about, you know, a new model that was being created on the spot, or cleaning up, or showing up when the other person isn't there on their shift. Whatever it was just to get the interns.
I remember
Or not playing the lottery. Go ahead.
Well, I just remember they sat us down and they said, okay, we're going to go 24-7 on September 19th, and we're going to put each of you on a part of the wall. So they said, Alicia, go 9 p.m. to midnight. And it was awesome because it was basically one-person devotionals. I remember Maggie Syrett played the flute on one of them. And it was amazing. There was no one in the room, but we still had the fire going.
As a matter of fact, I think some of you, two of you, were on the night watch. And so the glory of IHOP is the night watch. I mean, there's lots of prayer ministries. That's right. Go ahead. Give them a hand. To stand before the Lord by night. As a matter of fact, Mike made a famous mantra, even when fire in the night was birthed. We're taking back the night. We're taking it back. And so tell us a little bit about the community that was built in the night. Tell us a little bit about the glory that took place there.
I think the glory of the night watch is that it is a place where you have to lay everything else aside. It's also the pain of the night watch is that you have to lay everything else aside. But the glory of the night watch was that we had nothing else except 7-Eleven, and, you know, that's not that interesting at 3 a.m. in the morning. So it just kept us locked into the prayer room, and there were only a few of us doing it. So we were together day in and day out, plowing in the place of prayer through the night.
I remember my first couple years of being on the nights. I got here when I was 18, and I was a couple years out of high school. And I remember when I first heard about doing the night watch and just thinking, wow, I have a lot of friends who are doing other stuff in the night that I have chosen not to. So I considered myself as a signpost before the Lord, as an intercessor for those who were giving themselves to darkness. I said, you know what, I'm not going to do that. And to have the opportunity to, through the night, just sing love songs to the Lord.
And how old were you?
I was 18 when I got here. So at 18, I have the opportunity. You guys talk about it being the glory, and I'm like, I feel like it's our little secret that we got to do it and you didn't. So to get to love the Lord and to stand before the Lamb at 3 in the morning, while I know that I have friends that are getting drunk, while I know that there's darkness throughout our city, there's three of us, saying, Jesus, we love you. Jesus, we love you. You know, the darkness that is happening, the people that are chronically ill, they are mostly plagued in the middle of the night. We, as a company of young people, company equaling 3, 4, 5, 10, whatever. It was a small company. But just we felt the glory of that before the Lord in those first couple years. I still feel it today, too.
As a matter of fact, Mike, you had your own Luke lead the charge in the night watch.
That's right. We were, it was the summer of 99. Of course, you know, we started May 7th, and we went 13 hours a day for 4 months, May, June, July, August, and September. So I'm talking to my son Luke at home, and he's saying, when are we going to go 24-7? When's this thing going to go? You know, and everyone's asking the question. I said, well, son, I don't have anybody to lead the night watch. I said, the big task is the night watch. And I said, Hill said, I'll do anything. I said, do you want to lead the night watch? He said, I'll do it. Because I knew that if Luke was there, he would, at least would have them teach the apostolic prayers. Luke was a fanatic towards the apostolic prayers. So he said, I'll do it. And I said, really? I said, you know, think about it for a couple of days. And if you're really for real. And he said, no, I'll do it. I said, well, Luke, that's good. Because if it's not you, it's me. So it's better you than me. And so he took it on and started rallying together people and recruiting people. He was 20 years old, and he led it through, and he held the line on the apostolic prayers, is what I hear.
He held them very well.
That's my Lukey boy.
As well as the hymns of Revelation, the first 6 months that we had to sing through the hymns of Revelation? Those of you who sing now, we have an edited sheet, which is nice. He has deleted phrases such as, judge the harlot and you will drink their blood. And
yeah, we decided to delete those about 2002, but for about 2 years.
Yeah, but we learned that along the way.
Yeah,
that
we
it's
will
better.
Kill a harlot and they will drink blood, you know?
Yeah.
And so we were terrified. We were terrified to sing heresy. So we only sing those phrases because we had no
because
clue
it was the Bible.
What they meant.
It was the Bible. So you couldn't change the Bible, but I edited a few out to make it
later.
Yeah, about 2 years later.
Later. Right? So we judged the harlot. We sang about Babylon falling. And, I mean, it's in the middle of the night. And what we didn't know, I mean, I would sit there and be like, Alicia, you take the eyes around and within and the living creatures and their wings and all that. But what we didn't know was that he was rooting our hearts in the reality of gazing on the beauty of the Lord. And so in the middle of that, we're going, oh, do we have to judge the harlot again? But somewhere in the middle of that, we started developing the reality of getting our hearts rooted in another age and living before the Lord in the secret place. So I enjoyed that.
One thing I remember about the early night watch is that it was only a group of about 7 young people. It was led every night from midnight to 3 by Luke Sullivan. Leah Morgan, Amy.
I mean, Luke Sullivan was the worship leader.
He was
the
worship Luke leader.
And
Bickle was the prayer leader.
And Luke Sullivan were best buddies. So it was the two Lukes that working it together.
And we had Leah Morgan and Amy Cooper back then, Amy Farmer now, and a young 14-year-old named Crispin who came in every night and drummed. We had Jason Henderson and many, many others that came in for an hour or two. But those 7 or 8 people just stayed every single night and kept the fire burning throughout the night watch.
Adam Formby, remember him? He was there night after night.
Misty and I did the early morning part of the night watch for a while there, too.
At 3 a.m.
3 a.m. to 6 a.m.
You guys led those for, a couple years, it seems like?
Yeah, a couple years.
And don't forget.
Sorry, we used to have a couple sisters that would come in at 3 and 4 in the morning, would do the 4 a.m. shift, and then go to work all day. So they did that for a solid 3 or 4 years.
Wait, could you imagine? They would go to work at 7 in the morning. They would come in at 4 a.m. to lead worship before they went to work.
Mm-hmm. Navita and Cheryl.
Yeah.
Yes.
Navita and Cheryl, right. We all loved them. Mm-hmm.
And don't forget our beloved Stuart. In December 2001, actually Lisa Gottschall was Lisa Fisher, took over the night watch, and Stuart was her assistant. But in March 2002, Stuart took over, and he has led the night watch ever since.
Yeah, he joined it from day one. Stuart joined in the summer of 99. And then when the night watch began in September 99, he was part of it, but then he went and served Lisa. And I said, Lisa, you train that guy and you get him going straight. And Lisa gave him A's, really high grades, that he's humble, he's teachable, and he's got a good future. So Lisa recommended Stuart, and we gave it to Stuart on Lisa's recommendation, and it's been 8 straight years. Thank you, Stewie.
Yes, thank you, Stuart. Okay, I want to talk about something dear to us now. I want to talk about you, Mike, as the consummate, joyful coach in creating the model. I mean, how many of you remember in those first days when Mike was the consummate coach? And today, you have it easy. The prayer leader station is much further away from where they're praying.
I was right next to him in the early days.
Right next to you.
Hand
matter
on
of fact,
the neck.
The first time that I, one of the very first times I ever prayed at the microphone, I'm up at the microphone like this. Mike is right here. Right here. That close with that same glimmer in his eye.
And what you don't know, Alan was a worship leader. So Alan was a singer, worship, well, he still is. He's
I had
good.
Never sang anything at the microphone up to this time.
And so he says, Lord, break in with your power. And I said, Alan, sing it.
He did.
Sing it. Don't say it, sing it. He looked at me and goes, what do you mean? I said, sing it now.
Now. I go, what do you mean, sing it? He goes, now, just sing exactly
say,
what you pray.
Lord, break in with power. Sing it, was, it.
Now, here's, just like that.
Just like that.
Just like that.
I said, come on, big guy, do it.
Now, here's the terrifying thing. Everybody did whatever he said. If no. I had any inkling, I should have just dropped the mic and walked away. You did exactly. Sing it? Okay. Okay.
And you did that with so many people, too.
I did to everybody. There was no partiality. But if they didn't sing it, if they didn't sing it, I sang it right there. I said, if I can, you can. And they all, out of sympathy for the room, sympathy for me, something, they did it. I sang them right there on their microphone.
He was the consummate coach. And you actually were many times his guinea pig because he was creating the model as we went. Now, what you take so for granted or so familiar to you now that you can just learn the model in 30 minutes and jump right in and it's a great communication mechanism. Back then, to try to get worship leaders, singers, musicians, and intercessors flowing together in mutual cooperation, cultivating a prophetic spirit while engaging the room. Beloved, that was a train wreck in those early days. Everybody wanting to do everything that they wanted to do, and he forced us to play team. No one got their way. I can remember worship leaders actually not giving any room for intercessors. I remember one in particular just going, no. You are not praying, and just closed his eyes and kept leading.
The intercessors wrecked the whole set. No, we're not letting
And it was an intercession set.
And then the intercessors said, we're just going to break in and take over. And then there was mutiny on ship a couple of times.
There was mutiny. And it forced us all to defer to one another in love and have humility and trust in the process that we would learn.
He even made us a little signal that he would give us when the intercessors were praying too long, and that meant interject a song now. And so if the intercessor was praying, if they paused for a breath, we just went for it.
Bam, right in there. They shot in.
That was we were told that was the key to prophetic singing at that time, was knowing when the intercessor breathes so that you can jump in.
Yeah, and even if someone got up and prayed a prayer that was not from the Bible, our job was to pick one apostolic prayer, whichever one we wanted, and just sing it.
Just start singing the Bible. I said, if they start some crazy thing, just start singing the Bible.
I remember, and I don't know about what happened on the day watch, Stuart used to make us do clinics. Oh, my goodness. We were mad at him most of the time because he would make us sing down the line. So you think they're supposed to be prophetic flow, and Stuart was like, we need to learn to work together. Okay, so number one goes, number two goes, number three goes, number four goes, and number four is done, number one goes, number two goes, person prays, number three goes, number four goes. Oh, we were so mad at him. But it really did help develop us in teamwork and preferring one another and listening to each other, and it made us sing. Because how many of you have sung, but part of singing with people, if you're shy, you get to hide behind people, the other singers. So you assume that the other singers will sing, but in clinic, you had to do it. I also remember there were no auditions the first couple of years. So there was, there were open mics. If you, as a worship leader, did not have all of your singers there, the mics were open for people to jump up on.
It's what we called the five-minute rule.
Yeah, it was a five-minute rule.
Because we only had two singers or one singer or three up there, and if one didn't make it, I had a five-minute rule. We put it on the sign. We said, anyone in the room, after 5 minutes, if a singer doesn't come, because we only had, again,
you
many
did
times,
it
no
with
singers.
Drummers and bass players and
anybody
anything.
Could come to help the set. Because they wanted flowing music. I didn't want the fire to go out. I said, I would keep the fire going. So we would have singers from all manner of gift mix coming up there.
And I remember that part of that was because you had such a value on team ministry. So the more people on the mic, the better. So if you had six singers up there, you were so happy if all of them were antiphonalizing.
You know, Mike used phrases back in those days of building the ship at sea. Ready, fire, aim. As a matter of fact, you told the city to not even come for 5 years. You said, don't even show up.
Yeah, for three was the technical.
Was it three?
But at the dedication, I had three phrases at the dedication. Time when, you know, again, we were down here and at a conference, and we all marched, I mean, drove down the street to the trailers and then had the real dedication in the thing. I said, first of all, we're naming these trailers the Bethlehem Stables. Because I said, great things happen in the Bethlehem Stables. So I said, don't come here if you want it to look real good and look awesome. We don't know what we're doing. We don't have very many gifted people, not much going on, but we're going to do this thing. I said, we're building the ship out at sea. And the way this works, this is the dedication service. I said, the way it works, if we throw more, hold this for a second. Thank you, man. If we throw more water out of the ship than gets in, we win. I go, that's the goal. We're building this ministry. We're going to be throwing water that's getting in overboard, and we're going to make this thing work. And I said, we're going to dig a big hole, and we're going to lay a foundation. It's going to take us 3 years to dig this hole. We're going to have practice prayer meetings for three full years, and these practice prayer meetings, they count in the presence of God, but we're going to not worry about anything but practicing the Bible, singing together, flowing in the Spirit. We're going to practice how to do this. We're not going to perform for people. And so I said, if you want a great prayer meeting, because I met with all the pastors of the city, about 100 or 200 of them, and they said, tell us what you're doing. I go, don't even come for 3 years, because for 3 years, you'll come, and we'll be practicing prayer meetings. We won't ever stop, but we'll practice. I am drilling them. We're drilling, singing the Bible, singing together, apostolic prayers, hymns of revelation, singing the Psalms, because nobody knew how to do any of that when they came. So I said, now, I'm an architect. Not really. But I said, I'm an architect. I'm going to dig a big hole, build a foundation in it. If you're not an architect, you're going to come, I told the pastors, and all you're going to see is a big mud hole for 3 years. And you're going to say, I thought this was a prayer meeting. This is really dumb. But I said, if you're an architect, you'll come and say, wow, that is the best looking mud hole I've ever seen. I said, so if you're coming with the eye of a builder, then you can come. But if you're coming and you want to say, when are you laying the carpet? Don't even show up for 3 years, because it's going to be little, rough, and ugly. I said that over and over for 3 years. But then we're going to catch a flow together. We're going to have our hearts trained in the Bible. And then we're going to kick into a new gear about 3 year mark.
In fact, during that 3 years, it was everyone's opportunity to learn humility. And I want to tell you the perfect example of humility. I remember, you remember Deborah Hebert. Everyone remember Deborah Hebert here. She was the head section leader for many years at the very beginning. Well, Deborah and I were given the hard task of asking Julie Meyer to step down for a season while we were instituting new things. And I walked into that room as the associate director and Deborah as the head section leader.
She's been leading worship 25 years.
And I'm going, what are we doing? What are we doing? We sat down, and I don't know how the conversation went, but I remember asking, Julie, we have this new policy. We really feel like it's a time that you can step down for a season. It's everybody's opportunity to do X, Y, Z, da, da, da. And she looks at us, and she smiles, and she goes, okay, I want to do whatever helps this place the most. You're clapping. That's the right response. But I'm walking out of the room going, I am the biggest jerk on the planet. oh God. But she responded with such humility, and I remember that, Julie, that it touched my heart that here the person who had been since 1983 had responded in such a way that touched us. Everyone got a chance to humble themselves, to overcome fear, to do all sorts of things. And let's talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about the humility of learning to overcome our fear, whether it's sing your prayers or whatever it is. In fact, Misty, you seem so confident now. I mean, you seem so bold, but...
She was not bold at first.
What was it like when you first sang next to a Julie Meyer?
When I first started singing, I was singing next to people that I really admired, like Julie Meyer and Joanne McFadder and Chris Dupre, and Todd Gonofsky was singing at that time. And I just remember thinking, these are real prophetic singers, because I didn't want to be a singer. I wanted to be a prophetic singer.
You were 19 years old.
I was 19 years old. And I just thought, I don't know how they do it. I don't know why I'm standing here. I don't know what I'm doing. I would just close my eyes really tight and just go, God, what are you saying? What are you thinking? What are you feeling? What are you saying? Give me a phrase. Give me a picture. Give me a word. I got to prophesy. I had such hunger to prophesy, but it was incredibly intimidating.
I remember that too, just that same intimidation. I remember I would just have that in my mind. But they have a CD. They have a CD out. It just paralyzed me. And Mike was just like, they do have a CD, but you need to go up there and you need to sing this, the model. And I just remember over and over again just jumping off a cliff, just closing my eyes and going, okay, here I go.
Well, I gave him an option. I said, I'll go up there with you. But if you want me to go with you, they said, no, we don't want you with us.
I remember Misty's first devotional at the House of Prayer. And I think Dwayne found Misty.
I know he did.
Okay, just putting that on the record. So Dwayne, we were just searching for musicians and singers to fill up these hours that we need to be filled at the House of Prayer. And so Misty got recommended, and we would just, the way we would evaluate someone is by giving them a session in the prayer room.
You auditioned by taking a 2-hour session.
Yeah, so I remember this so clearly. I remember Deborah Heber and I were sitting over these chairs. I remember Mike walks over to me and he says, hey, you know, this girl Misty, she's going to sing, you know, Dwayne recommended her, you know, just because Mike was learning a lot of music terms, and I actually had music theory in my background, so I was making these cheat sheets for Mike on, like, you know, what are we looking for, or what's the melody line?
She was training me secretly on a couple of instruments.
I was helping a little bit. But anyways, and so he was asking me, you know, take some notes on this, you know, see what you think. And then up comes Misty, just by herself on the keyboard, opens up her mouth, and I mean, she starts singing through the book of Isaiah. I mean, she is just
her
like...
Her first set, 19 years old.
Yeah, Deborah and I are just mouth hanging open, just looking at each other, because the thing that burned in our hearts at that time was the Forerunner message. That was really what we were burning in our hearts, for that Forerunner message. And here was Misty singing the whole thing out. And then she also sang worship songs that she wrote. I mean, it was anointed. It was phenomenal. It was wow. And so the session ends, and the next team comes up, and Misty physically runs out of the prayer room. Like, she gets up from the piano and bolts. And Mike looks over and he goes, Shelly, get her. Talk to her. So I go running after her.
Don't lose that girl. Go get her.
So I go running after her, and I don't even remember what I said. I had something. I just said, oh, can I ride with you or something, because I remember we went in a car. I got to get something or whatever. And Missy's just going, I am so humiliated. Literally, she said this, I will never do that again.
Because she only knew two chords. You knew two chords or three.
I knew maybe three chords, maybe three songs, and 2 hours is a really long
It was good, though.
She knew three chords and three songs and just sang Bible verses and ran out of the room crying.
Right.
She's actually crying.
And I uttered this sentence of great and profound wisdom. I feel that this is actually part of your calling. And you will do this in the future. And she was just saying, no way. But anyway, it was just a time when we were all being pushed past our limitations.
I showed up when I was 18, and I knew how to play 3 chords, so I was handed a set as well. I remember being on a set, and I put my capo on, and my keyboard player looks at me. We didn't have any at that time. We had open monitors. My keyboard player looks at me and goes, what key are you in? And I go, you tell me. I don't know. So it was definitely the Bethlehem Stables.
I told her it was either G, E, or D.
It was B flat.
You know, we didn't know a whole lot. We were inexperienced. You knew 3 chords. I maybe knew 3 chords on the guitar. But, you know, you kept saying to us, Mike, Genesis 15:1, the Lord is our exceedingly great reward. And that's what we thought of. We thought of it wasn't whether anyone came to the room or not. He's our reward. And to feel the pleasure on our heart as we sang to him was the primary concern. And I remember that from the earliest days, feeling that nobility of singing to God. You set the foundation from the very beginning that the evaluation of our set wasn't whether the room was full or whether they responded, but did we sing to God? Did we posture our hearts in ministering to his heart? And in the process, did we experience his pleasure on our hearts?
Those hymns of revelation that he made us sing actually became the fuel, and to me still is the fuel. What keeps us in the place of prayer is the throne room scene. I remember Mike used to tell us that there were 50 people coming to the night watch. He used to say, and I'd be thinking, he hasn't stayed up in all night in a long time. Has he seen the five people that are there barely? Like, I literally would think, he knows what he's talking about. He seems smart.
No, we didn't think he knew what he was talking about.
No. I told him, I said, one day there'll be 100 people in the night watch. And they said, no way.
We would go.
There has to be 5,000 coming, so I figured at least 100 would do the night watch.
We would nod, and then later we would say,
I said, there will be 100 people, and they said, not a chance. I go, I promise you one day, hang in there, don't quit, there will be 100 people.
The complete unbelief you gave Bob Jones, we gave to you.
There you go.
Complete unbelief. And as we did the night watch night after night and with nobody in the room, we began to get our hearts rooted. We finally learned that if you open your eyes and try to do anything for anybody in the room, well, there was nobody in the room. I remember people asking me, it would be 8 o'clock in the morning, people would be like, well, how'd the night shift go? You know, how many people were in the room? I'd be like, 28, the 24 elders and the four living creatures, and me, 29. And but I meant it because I was beginning to learn how to minister to the Lord and it to be about that. And it is those early years so have helped to root my heart in understanding that I minister before the audience of one.
There was such a sense of expectancy as well, just that each time that could be a breakthrough from the Lord. There was no web stream, so if you missed it, you missed it. And the pain that we would have in our hearts about like, oh no, if we missed it. And I remember Misty, I just remember you during that period of time. It was almost like the pulling that the Lord had on your heart. You could not get away from that room. And can you tell just a little bit about what was in your heart on that?
There was a couple things in my heart on that. One is I didn't want to miss anything. So you just basically didn't sleep much those first few years. You just didn't know if that was the moment that the Lord was going to break in. And the second thing was I thought, if this thing is real, then I'm going to do it 100%. Either it's real and God loves prayer and he's going to answer our prayer, or it's not. And if it's not, I'm in big trouble. And half-heartedness made absolutely no sense to me, because if that is real, and we're talking about the uncreated God outside of time, you know, who sits above the circle of the earth, is listening to you, that's outrageous. If that's real, then...
Wait, say that again. That is outrageous.
It's outrageous. And when there's nobody in the room, it's empty. It's the middle of the night. This is your sixth set of the day, or however many you've done. The fact that the uncreated God is looking at you, and you close your eyes, and there's a locked gaze. You have to reach, though. There's an exercise of faith. I exercised so much faith in those early years because you had to believe it. It didn't make sense if you didn't believe he was listening. But if he's listening, nothing else made sense.
That's right. And there was nothing else on the org chart that you could see yourself expanding in. There was nothing.
We had no outreach ministries at first. You know, we had no. Now we got a dozens of them, but then we had none.
One branch on that organizational tree, the prayer room. That was it.
And the accounting office.
And the accounting office. But I tell you what, you know, when you look at the context we were in, we were in that trailer and the carpet was tattered. Literally, there were thousands of 3-inch screws that were holding the carpet down. If anybody fell out in the spirit, they hit the ground, smelled the carpet, and came up faster than they fell down. I'm not kidding. It was all tattered. You had to keep the lights on to keep the roaches at bay. I mean, the lights kept on. There were reasons. And so, but in all that setting.
Wait a second. I'm going to talk about that for a second. I was the one responsible for the bad carpet. Because when they put it in, I said, I want a prayer room. Because it's about a 200-seat prayer room where people can kneel down. So we put the double thick stuff underneath.
Which we ended up sweaty squish.
It ended up double thick. And I think, if I remember right, I told the guy, and some of the places on the side make it triple thick. And he said, there will be problems if you do. And I said, we'll deal with the problems later. I've never confessed this. I said, we'll deal with the problems later. And the carpet, everybody came in with drinks, so they spilled them on everything.
Because they tripped on the carpet, they spilled it.
Everything was spilled and sunk in, and the buckled, and people tripped. So we had to put tape where it buckled so people didn't trip. People were always walking, praying, tripping over the carpet. Then we had to nail it down. And the guy warned me. He goes, I told you that would happen. I'm sorry.
It's all right. But at the same time, though, the carpet was rough and tattered. We were inexperienced. We didn't know what we were doing necessarily. We were trying, giving in our best effort. But more times than not, the Spirit of Revelation would come into the room and someone would sing around the apostolic prayers, sing around the Revelation hymn, sing around the Word of God. And we were struck to the heart. More times than not, we would end up crying. We would be undone by that God had showed up to this little tattered room and had responded to us. You know, it's one thing to believe him in faith and to reach. It's another thing when he actually comes and stamps that reach with his presence. And I would watch people come from all over and come in that little room. And I would be almost embarrassed going, oh, my goodness, that leader's coming in this trailer. And they would be in tears within the hour. And the presence of God was so rich.
I remember when Alan Hood was leading worship. And we had a set one time, and we were...
Wait a second. Alan Hood is a good worship leader.
Yeah.
I am still annoyed that he does not lead worship. He used to lead worship. I loved his 2 p.m. sets with Carol. I would weep. It was beautiful. It was anointed, wasn't it?
It really was.
You
yeah.
have to do this.
Yeah.
No, I mean, for real. I would
the longer
sit there
we
and
go,
cry.
The better I become.
Go ahead,
it
Misty.
Really wasn't that good. I was there.
Go ahead, Misty.
No, but he wrote these. He had written these songs that were just so anointed and so from the heart of the Shulamite, which I loved hearing men write from the bridal paradigm. And with all the New Testament language, he just had written these songs and all of his language and St. John of the Cross. I mean, and we were up there singing one day, and we're singing around St. John of the Cross type themes and just, it was real tender. I mean, we were probably doing two chords. There was nothing musically going on, but we were looking at the Lord. And all of a sudden, I look over there, and he is just weeping and weeping.
The whole room was.
Well, there was nobody in the room.
That's what I mean.
He's weeping. And then the next thing I know, he just gets up in the middle of the set and walks out and never comes back. I think he went to the...
Field
or something.
He went out to the field. There was because a field behind that
there was
he
something
would run out to.
There's something about the, sorry, there's something about the smallness of it. I mean, when the Lord said, go to your closet to pray, there was something about the smallness of it that made you reach for the presence. But the truth is the same presence is still here. We're just more distracted, or we're prone to being more distracted. It's actually still here, you know, looking at us, waiting for us to just look back. Sometimes it takes a little more effort.
Well, we have so
still
many
here.
Ministries, so many outreaches, so many options, so many relational things going on, so many things to do. The prayer room can be the last thing on the priority.
He's just like,
but
sit
the,
down
for the
and
first
look at
couple
me.
Years, it was the one, like you said, thing on the org chart.
But you know what? We take that for granted. But we need to realize the nobility of what we're doing, and his presence is with us. His presence in that room, I watch visitors week after week and come in and say, my life was changed sitting in that chair over there. And we need to realize it now, even as we're doing this, that even if revival doesn't break in my day, but my son's day, the nobility that I got to do this before God, and it counted, and it mattered. Just like in 1983 to 1999, they labored. We're reaping the fruits. We're laboring. Somebody else might reap the fruits, but it counts.
Well, we're going to finish this segment of the evening, and we're going to have a video for you. And it's the same video we showed at the 7-year anniversary. I asked John, I go,